I'm going to assume that most of you have heard the name Johnny Erickson Tada before. She is a well-known Christian who has, you know, a disability that has affected her life in every way possible. She was a very athletic, very active teenager who had just come to know Jesus Christ, and she dove into the water, hit her head, and separated between the fourth and fifth vertebrae of her spine, and she lost the use of her legs and her arms. Completely dramatic injury that changed the rest of her life. And you can imagine what that must have been like for a brand new Christian, right? Because when you come to Christ, aren't all your problems supposed to go away? And life is supposed to be greater than it's ever been? But what we quickly find out is that that's not quite how this thing works. We're in this world where there's lots of troubles and dark times and times when we don't know what's going on and we're confused. We're wondering if God is still there. We're questioning the promises, but our feelings are what's causing us to do that. All that can be true. And that was true for Johnny Erickson Tada. She was to the point where she was having suicidal thoughts and wanted to no longer live. Because, you know, she had spent her early life with success in the athletic world. Well, since then, she's, of course, made peace with what happened. She's recorded CDs for people who like music. She learned to paint with a toothbrush, paintbrush between her teeth, and she became very good at it, at selling her art. But what we know her best for is that she started a ministry to the disabled. And she's in every country around the world really ministering to people. Wherever she's invited, she ministers. How is it that God can take those moments in our lives when the worst possible thing happens? We think life could never go on from this point, and yet somehow it's like a seed that he uses in the future for things we never dreamed of. Yeah, I don't know how God does that. And I don't know most of you. I don't know right now where you are in your life. I don't know your circumstances. But I would, you know, imagine that there's a fair amount of pain in this congregation today. And perhaps some pain that hasn't been spoken of. Perhaps pain you carry in week in and week out and, you know, you just carry it until you can't. We've all been there. We've all had those dark thoughts, those dark times. Could this really be my life? And will this be my life for the rest of my life? I want to talk about that this morning. And I want to talk about it from, I think, a pretty familiar character in the Bible. His name was Joseph. I would invite you to start opening your Bibles to Genesis chapter 41. Because Joseph's life changed dramatically when his brothers, okay, his flesh and blood, his family, sold him into slavery. That was like a traumatic injury. I learned a simple lesson from Joseph's hardships. This is the lesson, and if you're a note taker, it is in the notes. I'm just going to talk about one simple idea today. A painful life, perhaps your painful life, a painful life can become a fruitful life. You know, your painful life, whatever pain you go through, God will never waste it. Somehow he'll use it to make your life, yeah, better than you may have ever dreamed. Get opportunities you never saw coming, you never would have experienced had you not gone through that time of darkness. Joseph is a great illustration of that. He went through family betrayal. He went through unjust accusation. He went through undeserved punishment, wrongfully imprisoned, and left there for years wondering, what were those dreams really all about when I was a young teenager? When God was giving me dreams that someday I would have a influence, I would be a man of position. Here I am rotting in prison. A lot of good those dreams did. Put yourself in his place. Perhaps it's not so hard. Let's hold on to that thought. A painful life can become a fruitful life. I'd invite you to follow along as I read three verses from Genesis 41, verses 50 through 52. Before the years of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph by Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh and said, "It is because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household." The second son he named Ephraim and said, "It is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering." So it's not hard to see where I've gotten my central idea today. You know, that painful life that can become a fruitful life. But let's back up just for a second. We need to know what "before the years of famine came" refers to. Well, Joseph was in prison, remember, wrongly so, and there for many years. One of the experiences he had there was that the jailer put him in charge of everything, because everything Joseph's hands touched just seemed to turn to gold. Even though he's imprisoned, he's a prisoner, yet everything he does is wise and good and benefits those around him. He's there in that prison, and two royal officials are imprisoned with him one day. The baker and the cupbearer of the king. Both of them had made Pharaoh upset, and Pharaoh had put them in prison. And on the same night, both of those officials had a dream that really disturbed them, and they did not know what it meant. The next morning, Joseph could see. They were distraught. They had a conversation, and then Joseph interpreted their dreams. Both interpretations came true. Just within a couple of days, the baker was executed. The cupbearer was restored to his position with Pharaoh again. And Joseph had said to the cupbearer, "When you're released and you're restored to your position, please remember me. I'm here in prison. I've been here a long time. I want my freedom. I'm here because of something I did not do." Well, unfortunately, this cupbearer, with his regained freedom and his restoration to his position, forgot all about Joseph for 2 years. I just want you to think about that for a minute. I want you to think about your own pain. What if it goes a couple more years? It's not hard to imagine. If we have lived some life, we know some long valleys, right? Some tough times in our lives that don't end real quickly. 2 more years for Joseph of waiting, languishing in prison, wondering what God is up to. Well, 2 more years goes by, and Pharaoh has his own disturbing dream, and none of his wise men can tell him what it means. And this jogs the cupbearer's memory. And he says to Pharaoh, "Oh, I forgot. There's this young man, Joseph. He's in prison. He told us our dreams and what they meant. You need to send for him." So, of course, Pharaoh sends for Joseph. He's cleaned up, brought before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh explains his dream. And Joseph interprets it. He says, "The next 7 years, there's going to be great bounty in the land like you've never seen. But 7 years after that, there's going to be famine like you've never seen, and the bounty will be forgotten." And Joseph added a little piece of advice. "Let Pharaoh find a wise man, good at administration, to store up food during the 7 good years, so that in the 7 bad years, the nation will be saved." Pharaoh recognizes talent when he sees it. He says, "There can be nobody better than you." So he gives him this position, but he takes it up another level. He says, "Joseph will now be number 2 in the land. He will be like me everywhere except for one place, and that is when I sit in the throne." Ah, maybe that did not erase the pain or remove the scars from Joseph's life, but it certainly put some things into perspective. Because that long, painful season had now culminated in him seeing what God had been doing all along. This isn't simply hindsight. I want to explain it this way. Sometimes we can't see what God's doing until God decisively acts. The question is will we hold on to him and trust him long enough to see when he decisively acts? Because sometimes we give up just a little too soon. I'm sure Joseph wanted to give up many times, but now here he is, given a position by Pharaoh and having influence like he never dreamed. Well, during the 7 years of great abundance, Joseph had some personal things take place which were very gratifying. He got married and he had two sons. And he names these two sons. And he gives them very personal names. He writes into their name his life story. He wants to train these sons to know that God is faithful even in the darkest times of our lives. Even through the seasons that were far too long, much longer than we wanted, and much deeper in terms of pain than we ever wanted, that still, even in that kind of a painful life, God is faithful and our lives can become fruitful. I want to talk about those two sons, for both names tell an aspect of Joseph's painful and fruitful life story. Verse 51 tells us about Joseph's first son, and verse 52 tells us about his second son. Joseph's first son was named Manasseh. Joseph chose this name in honor of God's healing touch. I want you to hold on to that thought. Manasseh is chosen because God can heal. I was a pastor for many years before God called me at midlife to step out of the pastorate into a different vocation, which is now hospice chaplaincy. I get to walk with lots of people who are watching a loved one die at the end of their life. Or I spend a lot of time with individuals who don't have family who are at the end of their life. I have seen a lot of pain that people carry with them. Have you ever had that kind of pain in your life? Like, you may not be on hospice, but you feel like life is over. Do you believe God can heal you? Because I'll tell you, as human beings, I think oftentimes this is kind of how we think. God can heal other people. He just don't want to heal me. God hears me when I pray for other people. He just doesn't answer my prayers. Otherwise, how do I explain why I've been in this painful rut for this long? How do I explain God's seeming inactivity? How do I wrestle with thoughts when I think God just does not really care about me? Joseph chose the name Manasseh because he was celebrating the fact that God heals us. Not in our time, of course, but in his good time. Joseph said, God helped me to forget. You see that? In verse 51, what does Manasseh mean? Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh and said, it is because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. Did Joseph forget? Did Joseph forget? when his brothers threw him in a well? Did Joseph forget when he begged for his life and they showed no pity or remorse and looked down at him and laughed? Did Joseph forget the day that his father clothed him in a robe of many colors? Did Joseph forget the whispers of his brothers behind his back, the malicious faces they made when he came around, the angry words with which they spoke to him? Did Joseph forget? Did Joseph forget when the slave traders came by and his brothers hoisted him up out of the well and sold him for 30 pieces of silver? Did Joseph forget when he was unjustly accused of touching another man's wife, which he didn't do? Did he forget when he got thrown into prison and forgotten for years? The answer is no. He did not forget any of that. He went through all of it. He felt all of the pain of it. He dealt with all of the anger, all of the questions, all of the grief. He did not forget. What does this mean? Have you forgotten what's happened to you? He says, God helped me forget. Like Joseph, we can't erase painful memories as if they never happened. What it means is that God helped him know what to do with it when he remembered. Joseph could live as if all of that happened for a purpose. All of that happened for a reason. And when God decisively acted, it made sense. He couldn't wipe his memory like a dirty window, like we get out some Windex and we clean it, or we use the windshield wipers on the car with some windshield wiper fluid. That's not how it works. The fact that Joseph forgot meant that his perspective shifted. He did not need to hold the grudge. He did not need to engage in self-pity. He did not need to imagine the painful punishment that his brothers deserved. He did not need to let the poison of bitterness consume him. That's what it means to forget. It doesn't mean that painful memories never enter our brain. It means when they do, we can give them the door. That's what Joseph learned to do. It's kind of like fasting. If you've ever fasted for prayer purposes or fasted for blood work, you chose not to consume. It's the same thing. When thoughts come that we remember, we do not need to feed our minds over and over and over again with those thoughts. Our perspective can shift. And each time we do that, we find it easier to turn our attention to God and what He is doing now instead of being held back by what happened when. To forget meant that Joseph chose not to let painful memories become permanent splinters. If you're like me, as soon as you get a splinter, you want it out. Doesn't feel so good. Think of those memories as splinters. We are the ones who are to take those thoughts captive and remove those splinters and replace those thoughts with something else. See, time had lessened the sting of betrayal, not because the betrayal didn't happen, but because Joseph lived long enough to see that God decisively acted. Can I just say to you, if you are waiting for God to act, just don't give up today. Will you at least say, God, I'll give you another day? And then tomorrow, if you're still there, will you say tomorrow, God, I'll give you another day? You see, the troubles of our lives are awful hard to carry if we think we need to carry them for the rest of our life. But if we can just shift to say, all I need to do is carry this trouble today. And if you want to back that up even further, just say, all I have to do is carry that right now. God, would you just help me carry it right now? Even if I'm not sure I can live here another day, just help me do it now, today. This is what the name Manasseh tells me. Hey, Steve, it's time to move on. Don't let your past memories cripple you. Don't let your past memories leave you in inactivity. We can move on. With God's help, we can move on beyond all that pain. And even while we're carrying that pain, we can stand up and we can move. See, these painful memories can become like faded scars instead of open wounds. You know, when I was in high school, my senior year, our baseball team went to the Western Maine final. We were playing one of our chief rivals. We had two chief rivals, Greeley and Gorham. I went to Cape Elizabeth. So maybe they're still rivals, I don't know. But we were playing Gorham on their field, and we were the favorites to win the state championship that year. But Gorham had one game better than us in the regular season and had home field advantage. And it was the last inning, and we were losing. And I was at the plate, and I got walked. I stole second, and the next batter hit a home run. We're all celebrating. We're up by a run. And I think we scored a couple more runs. It was a good inning. We felt pretty confident. We had a good pitcher on the mound in the bottom of the seventh. Gorham loaded the bases. There were two outs. They'd scored a run. They were down by one. Batter at the plate popped up, our pitcher caught it, we all celebrated at the mound that we'd won, and we're going to the state championship. Gorham proceeded to clear the bases and started to celebrate like they won. What we didn't realize was that the catcher had interfered with the batter, the bat had hit his glove. Gorham saw the ump call it, and they cleared the bases. What the umpire did was, because it was a dead ball, the batter got first base, one run scored. Next kid hit a two-run single, we lost. I was a senior. All the seniors were pretty bummed. But when I stole second base, I ripped all this up. I still have the scar. I can show you if you want to see it. That loss doesn't bother me anymore, but I have the proof that we lost right here. Do you have some proof that you've had some hard times? It may not be a scar on your body, but I can tell you the scars are up here, and it doesn't take much to bring it to the surface. Those don't need to be open wounds for you anymore. They can be scars that are fading. God can help you move on. He's the healer. He can help you forget in His way of forgetting. What do you need to make peace with? Well, there's a second son that Joseph names, and again, he names him to teach him something of how God works through life's darkest moments. Verse 52, the second son he named Ephraim and said, it is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. Joseph chose this name in honor of God's pruning touch. See, God not only heals us, God prunes us. Do we have any gardeners in here? You know, pruning happens sometimes in the spring, sometimes in the fall. But if you want your plants to blossom and flourish, you prune them. I have this wonderful fire and ice hydrangea out in the front of our house, which I pruned Oh, now it's so big. It's beautiful. Pruning happens to us whether we would like it to or not. You know, God hasn't once yet come to me and said, Steve, would you mind if I did some pruning today? You know, the pruning just happens, and I'm the one who says, do you know what you're doing? Anyone else up there I can talk to? You ever been there with me? You know, I have these thoughts in the car. I'll be like, God, you don't listen to me. Well, you do when I pray for other people, but you don't listen to me when I pray for myself. And then another minute goes by, and I go, but who else am I going to talk to? I mean, right? Where else am I going to go? Is this how we live, right? We trust God, but we don't. Right? Well, I mean, we trust him, but there's days we don't. Yeah. We're human. We're like that father. You know, heal my son if you can. Everyone else has failed. I mean, I've been asking for years. He's still no better. You know, if you can, God, if you got a little time, maybe you could do something. I mean, that's human. That's us. We have such faith when we pray for somebody else, but when we pray for ourselves, see, we run the risk of disappointment. We just don't understand God. We just don't understand his ways. We don't until God's decisive action. So here's these two sons. Imagine Joseph teaching Manasseh, son, you can move on. God will always help you move on. Now he's talking to his other son, Ephraim, and he's going to teach him a lesson about how God works in dark times too. God made Joseph fruitful in the soil of suffering. I want you to hear this statement. God can bring a good crop from bad soil. Now, I know there's the parable of the sower, and yeah, there's good soil when it comes to faith in our hearts. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, do you believe that the soil of your life is something God can plant something good in? God can bring a good crop from bad soil. God can reap an abundant harvest in your darkest time of life. Picture big, juicy tomatoes on a tomato plant. In ground that you thought nothing could grow in. Picture a fruitful life in the midst of a painful one. What is the suffering that Joseph became fruitful in? I mean, we've mentioned it. Family betrayal, imprisonment, being left there to rot, being forgotten, being betrayed, rejected, unloved, unwanted, neglected. Yet, he became fruitful. I became fruitful in the land of my suffering. That word suffering, that Hebrew word suffering, is used in so many ways. It's so colorful. In the Old Testament, it describes depression. If you've ever lived with depression, you know how terrible it is. It can describe being forced to submit to injustice. It describes misery as if you're unloved. It was Jacob's wife, Leah, that's how she felt. Her rival, Rachel, was loved more than her. It describes people who are enslaved, the Jewish nation in Egypt. It describes people who felt cheated and mistreated, Jacob by his father-in-law. It describes women who deal with barrenness, like Hannah, who prayed for Samuel. It describes those who are bereaved, like Job, who lost all of his children. And it describes people who are publicly cursed and mocked, like David when he fled the palace only to be pelted with rocks and told that he was the scum of the earth. And Joseph says, in the land of my suffering, God made me fruitful. None of us want to face that stuff. None of us want to face that. None of us want to watch a child walk out the door and go their own way and walk away from God and pray for years for that prodigal to return. None of us want to go through that. None of us want to go through deep marital pain for a long time. None of us want to suffer joblessness and a search for years. None of us want to lose a child far too young or get a terminal diagnosis. Watch our family go through that or watch our loved one go through that. We don't sign up for these things. What's God going to do with all that? We are prone to view suffering as worthless sand. Nothing grows in this. Yet God looks at it and he sees rich potting soil. And he plants, and he waters, and he tends, and he grows. And all while we're completely convinced nothing's happening, something's growing underground until finally it bursts through the surface and we see God's decisive action and we say, oh, it makes sense. Pain does not need to stop us if it seems slow. Pain is not an insurmountable barrier for God. And we don't need to sink in our suffering or drown in bitter disappointments. This is what the name Ephraim teaches me. Not only can I move on, it means God can help me move up. I mean, from prison to the second in command of Egypt, Joseph moved way up. This is God's pruning touch, just as Manasseh is God's healing touch. You know, I can't really figure a better way to say this. You know, if we want a blessed life, right? You know, there's no way to have a blessed life without taking our lumps. You got to get some bruises and maybe some broken bones. God the Father has not had a son yet that didn't suffer. Hasn't had a daughter yet that didn't suffer. But he's never left one of them. Oh, yes, we've accused him of leaving us. And you bet I have. Lately. Join me in some of my car rides. You'll hear a few things that you'll be like, whoa. People pray like that? I do. I tell God what's on my mind. My language might not always be nice. I'm pretty raw and honest with God sometimes. Let's be confession time here. But you know what? God's never left me. And the illustration I would give you would be 12 men in a boat with Jesus asleep. They thought he didn't care about them. But here's the thing. He was present. He just wasn't acting the way they thought he should. That's me. See, he doesn't act the way I think he should. And what's the first thing I say? You're gone. You're not around. You don't care. He was present. He just wasn't acting the way I thought he should. Those 12 men in the boat, they're bailing. They think they're going to die. They wake him up. They're like, don't you care? We're about to drown. He was there. Is it possible sometimes in our theology we get mixed up? See, we equate him being there with him doing something. Do you? Does God have to do something to be there? Just food for thought. Which name do you relate to the most? Do you need to be a Manasseh and move on, or do you need to be an Ephraim and move up? Or do you need a little bit of both? Last Sunday, I had the privilege of hearing a sermon by a young man named Matt. When I was a young pastor serving down in Wells, Maine, I used to preach at this Christian school called Seacoast Christian Academy, and Matt was a student at the time. So it was a real privilege for me to hear a sermon from him on Sunday. He's a really good young man serving the Lord. And he shared a story which I asked his permission to share today. I thought it would close this sermon well. Matt told a story about a man named Dave. Dave was a former pastor and professor who was the men's leader in the church in Texas that Matt was serving at the time. And this man, Dave, was diagnosed with a very aggressive form of cancer. And he quickly deteriorated. And one of the things that Dave liked to do to get out of the house was he would go down to the neighborhood pool. There was like a local pool, and he would go down and he'd walk laps. Well, as this cancer was ravaging his body, he couldn't really get from his house to the car or from the car to the pool. So some of the men of the church on a rotating basis would go to the house on a daily basis, carry him to the car, get him to the pool, carry him to the pool, get him in the pool, and then they would get in the pool and walk laps with him. And one day it was Matt's turn to do this for Dave. And Matt knew it was probably the last time he would see Dave. So as they're walking their laps, very, very slow laps, Matt, not quite knowing what to say, asked Dave, "Hey, Dave, what's God showing you right now?" And Matt said that Dave walked a lap or two before he finally answered. And when he answered, this is what he said: "I don't think we do a great job differentiating between faith and trust." Then they kept walking. And Matt's like, explain what you mean to me. And Dave said, "I have faith that God can heal me, but I trust him either way." Do you have faith God can change your situation? But will you trust him if he doesn't?